subgenres, I was saying there's these koans that Louise has been telling you about. And the way a talk starts traditionally is with a koan. And so here we go. This is the first koan in one book, The Book of Serenity. And it's sort of parallel to the first koan in the first book of koans, which is Mu. One day the world-honored one, which is the name for Buddha, ascended the seat. Manjushri struck the gavel and said, "Clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus." The world-honored one, Buddha, then got down from his seat, and that's the end. So, Louise has dragged you along to a ceremony, or a form of, I don't know what, a practice, where, which can be summed up with thus. Nothing else needs to be said. So therefore, I'm going to plow ahead and say some things. So, one of the things that koans do is the same thing that art does, which is it frames things, and so that we can take notice of it. And the Manjushri's introduction to Buddha's non-response is sort of parallel to this. This is a book called Buddha Mind in Contemporary Art. Four people sitting around a table with nothing in it, or apparently nothing in it. And sort of the opposite of what we just had of visitor Lo Sang Samten, who had a similar platform and he had nothing in it and then he filled it up with sand. And the question is that different? And we need the frames to renew our understanding of things. And we need art for the similar reasons, so that we can do as Manjushri, who is the sort of the guy who embodies wisdom. He apparently taught the first six Buddhas, the ones that preceded the Buddha, at least in metaphor. And so if we have things reframed, all of a sudden we can see them clearly. And this is true. There's a famous symbol in Zen, the circle, the empty circle, or a circle with a little bit of a hole in it. In contemporary art, John Cage, the musician, avant-garde composer, composed something called 433, which was people gathered to this. A man sat at the piano. He lifted the what do you call that? That covers the keyboard. He lifted the thing that covers the keyboard. And sat down and didn't play anything. And then halfway through, he closed the keyboard and they continued singing. And this was quite, I read about this recently, it was quite a moment because it happened in Woodstock, New York, which was, you know, back in the 1950s, that was too radical for them. And one of my students did this. He's been studying composing. He did this at Lo Sang Samten's thing. He was reading a poem, and then there was a long period of silence. And in the silence, everything, you know, the ambient noise came in. And then someone flushed a toilet, which was, you know, all part of it. And so we don't listen to the silence, and then when we listen to the silence, we realize it isn't silent. There's always someone flushing a toilet somewhere. And, you know, Andy Warhol did this with camel soup cans. One moment that was a remarkable moment in American movie history was the movie American Beauty, where there's quite a long period where you watch this piece of paper swirling around in the air. There's a guy who's very strange and disturbed fellow, but he's watching this paper just, right? Something that we would not pay any attention to. A dancing piece of paper. Basho, in my favorite haiku, said, even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's cry, I long for Kyoto. So we're schlepping along in our everyday concerns. Cuckoo, something from the wild comes, and all of a sudden our hearts fall of longing. So we often hear the phrase now, it is what it is. That's become the new whatever. And and like all of these, just like, you know, the Nike thing, just do it. You know, these all have taken these archetypal bits of wisdom and commodified them. And yet, it is what it is really what Manjushri's saying there. You know, it's thus. It's thus. And we can't, you know, it's thus, and it's something so profound we can't sum it up, we can't talk about it in language, we can't frame it. So here we are, we just sat for a little while, and we were silent. And during that time, at least we were not burdening one another or retailing our thoughts to one another. And that was a relief to some extent. We may have been retailing or wholesaling our thoughts to ourselves. So, you know, is it silent in the silence? And at best, we were observing our breath. And then noticing when we were stopped, when we had stopped observing and that we were thinking. And language was coming in there. Language is also a frame, but it's not language that necessarily refreshes our view of things. Language, when it comes washing through us, just like all of the popular culture, all the noise of the culture, it ceases being a frame, and we mistake that language for the world. That's one of the paradoxes of the person making the sun mandala. The world that he's making is the world of illusion. Losang was very amused that there was a perfume that came out with great, I think it was, you know, a major perfume manufacturer had a perfume called Samsara, because it sounded good, Samsara. But when it was pointed out to them that samsara means suffering, and sort of, well, maybe we just wasted several $100 million, and so that you can't find samsara anymore. Too bad, because it's really a good form of suffering. So we get in trouble when we mistake the created world for all that it is, and even though language is a glory, it's a snare. So one of the things that has puzzled me all these years while meditating is there's a sort of contradiction in meditation. I think we've all noticed this. When you sit down to meditate, you're to follow your breath and not add anything, except perhaps in number 1 to 10, as Deborah just pointed out to you. You know, you breathe out 1 to 10, and when you strip that number down, it's just a syllable, and you can disappear into that syllable, and it helps us keep our mind relatively free of thinking. And if we can sustain that concentration, then spaciousness arises. That's why we go on these retreats, because it's very hard for the brain to quiet down in the short term, really get quiet. And yet, in fact, it's not only very hard, it's impossible. And yet, when that happens, everything, including the toilet flushing, is a form of music. The bird song can be appreciated for just what it is. One of my favorite things is these swirls that go around the knots, and how skillful the tree is in negotiating its way around this complication, this thing that is sprouting out of itself in order to help itself grow and become a tree. You don't find unskillful versions of that, although every way of negotiating it is different. Sometimes it doesn't swirl around, sometimes it just collides right into it and then resumes on the other side. So that's the kind of thing that you can actually see wisdom in if you are framing the silence with the sitting. So we follow the breath, but most of the time we're not following the breath. The fact is that we're thinking, and we are swept along like that, like some piece of styrofoam as the tsunami comes in, and it's carried inland, and we drop it. And Deborah said, "Just drop it. Don't. What did you say when you said?" Don't stress about it. Don't beat yourself up over it. But, over the years, I have practiced that. Don't beat yourself up over it. But there's still, I say, I've just spent my time being angry at this person at work. Oh, why? What a waste of time. And then, wait a minute, you're not supposed to beat yourself up. And so we get off into this and... We're brought back to this adding something extra to the mute eloquence of the moment. And that adding something extra is one of the things that Zen would lead us not to do, but it doesn't stop. And I think Dogen, although I hesitate to say Dogen is a famous guy who was really smart, an early Zen guy, and he said if you want to follow the way, this is one of the most famous things in Zen, you must study the self. To study the self is to forget the self and open to all the myriad things of the world. So, what does he mean, study the self? One of the ways in which we come to ourselves in Zen is through observing that thought process, the adding on, the extra adding on. And what Dogen meant when he said study the self, I'm not completely sure. But even though we sit down just to breathe, we're constantly brought up at the tapestry, the mandala that our consciousness, that's too elegant a phrase for it. The tangle, I guess, right? The tangled vines that our mind breathes. But if we don't study them, then we have no chance of ever opening to the things. Because ultimately, it's humbling to notice how caught we are. Ultimately, it's liberating to notice how caught we are. And our own caughtness becomes the grounds for our compassion for other people. If we can't do this simple thing, can't we understand everyone in there? In their tangle. We're all in the tangle. And then we let go of it. And then we have, a moment of clarity. If you look on the internet, I've said this before, if you look on the internet, you find different estimates of how many thoughts we have in the day. Some people say 10,000, other people say 20,000, some people say 70,000 thoughts a day, which is really a lot of thoughts, I mean, quote-unquote thoughts. Mind farts might be a better phrase. And yet, some very huge percentage of them are the same as yesterday's thoughts. So these are the deeply habitualized ways that we have of negotiating. If we had to learn freshly how to drive the car each time, we would never get out of the driveway. And so we need that, then that's also the thing that needs to be also. There's nothing like hitting something with your car to rearrange your frames of judgment about what it is in a car, or your relative illusion of safety. We don't know how frail we are. There was an incredible accident just yesterday at the corner by the McDonald's there. Four cars. One was just completely smashed up. And they were all taken to the hospital. So, we want so much to be at home. And yet, when we think about that, or when we think at all, in a certain way, we are leaving that wordless at-homeness. And yet, we must leave that wordless at-homeless. I mean, the thinking itself is almost a sign that we are not at home, even while in Zen terms, you're always at home. So one of the things that's so instructive about the guy who came to do the mandala is that he is so clearly at home. So clearly. Wherever he is. He doesn't need anything extra. So we may live in Teaneck or Peoria. We may flush the toilet or have a meal. But really, where we live is in this great plenitude of emptiness in our heart. It's a good one. Even if that emptiness is filled with our daily mandala or our daily time tangle. And we have all of our ways of keeping ourselves distracted from who we are. You know, poor me, resentful me, angry me, greedy me, ignorant me, or wonderful me, under-recognized wonderful me, kind, under-recognized wonderful me, or whatever it is. They're all little tangles that we add on. And whether we're tearing ourselves down or building ourselves up, we are affirming our illusion of our ego. Or sometimes we can just direct it outward and be angry. And that anger can feel good for a while. Now I'm alive. You know, it's like anger is like this huge turbine and like the Hoover Dam. The water comes roaring through. We spin, electricity goes out, and the electricity is like a frame for our life. The grid is a frame for our life, and we mistake the electricity for the life. Not that they're ultimately separable. So we can say, as we like to say, LePage. Putin. If we just sat right now and we start listing our pet peeves, we could be here till next week. You know, we would just be we'd have such a debauchery of things that we would have. And if we sort of fell silent for a moment, all we'd have to do is turn on the computer and in 2 seconds we'd have a whole other range of things that we could be pissed off about. And let's go back to Dogen for a second. Yeah, studying the self implies an observer in this provisional way. The provisional observer can see that we are being angry and can see that being angry is an illusion, is a self-entanglement, is a way of staying silent. And even though we want to go beyond that dual self into just unity, there's a waitress at the Early Bird who has a tattoo. It says, one love on it. And, you know, if it's just love, there is no observer. But if we don't see what interferes with that love, we can't see it at all. So, I wandered freely away from my text here. maybe wandered lost. So I just want to come around, and it's going to be poetry time now. I'm going to be an example of clearly observing. I think we have enough copies for everybody. Thank you very much. And this is where the computer might come in, if possible. There's a guy named Hokusai, who was a 19th century Japanese painter, very, very famous guy. I believe this poster here is one of the biggest selling posters in the world. And it was, I noticed here, it was in 2009 voted the best graphic on Google. So this is a woodcut, but he did these hundreds of these. His most famous painting, I think, is The Wave, which looks like a big tsunami. You may have seen this before. It's this one here. It's probably not big enough for you to see. I don't know if Jane was doing this, she could help us. So, this wave right here, famous painting of the wave.
We're back at the end.
Oh, well, okay.
Is that like a slideshow?
It's a slideshow. I don't know how to stop the slideshow.
Arrow keys?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know how to stop it. Maybe your space bar?
Okay, right there. There's the wave. Big picture of the wave. Right in the background there is Mount Fuji. He painted this Mount Fuji. He did woodcuts of Mount Fuji by the hundreds. There was the 36 views of Mount Fuji, and each one was radically different, but it's all Mount Fuji. This one is seen through the curve in the crest of the wave. If he had 70,000 thoughts a day, many of them were Mount Fuji, but he kept changing the frame. So, why don't we just go around and everybody read a stanza here. Some of them are just one-line stanzas. So, does everybody have enough life to read this? Okay. So I'll start, and then we'll go to Pam. Hokusai says, look carefully. He says, keep looking. Stay curious. He says, there's no end to seeing.
He says, look forward to getting old. He says, keep changing. You just get more who you really are. He says, get stuck. Accept it. Repeat. Yourself as long as it's interesting.
He says, keep doing what you love.
He says, keep praying.
He says that every one of us is a child. Every one of us is ancient. Every one of us has a body. He says every one of us is frightened. He says every one of us has to find a way to live with fear.
He says everything is alive. Shells, buildings, people, fish, mountains, trees, wood is alive, water is alive.
Everything has its own life. Everything lives inside of us. He says, live with the world inside of you.
He says, it doesn't matter if you draw or write books. It doesn't matter. If you saw wood or catch fish, it doesn't matter. If you sit at home and stare at the ants on your veranda or the shadows of the trees and grasses in your garden, it matters that you care.
It matters that you feel.
It matters that you notice.
It matters that life lives through you.
Contentment is life living through you. Joy is life living through you. Satisfaction and strength is life living through you. Peace is life living through you.
He says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid.
Look, feel, let life take you by the hand. That life lives through you.
What about this? What do you think?
Wonderful.
Yeah. How so?
It really is a good answer to the why bother. Because it matters. It's up to you. I mean, it puts the responsibility where it needs to be, and you just move along. Thus.
Thus. Yeah. So there's that emptiness. I mean, do other people have other things to say about it? Look carefully. Keep looking. And these are all things that we take away as essential messages from Zen. Hokusai was a Nichiren Buddhist, but his great teacher was one of the classic Zen painters, Seishun, I believe is his name, and there's no end to singing. There's no beginning to singing.
Brings you back to the calm.
I think you're back to the calm. Thank you very much.
What does the original manuscript of this poem look like? Do you know that?
No, this is not. This is Roger Keyes. I don't know who Roger Keyes is. I forgot to look him up. He might be Mr. Nobody. I don't know. You know, that's like Emily Dickinson. I'm nobody. Who are you? I've never heard of him as a poet before. But so he's looking through the eye, let life live through you. He's looking at this thing or the next one. It says, order a hand-painted reproduction of this painting. So you can't really look at these things without getting the next bit of buy this. You've got to have this thing right here.
And if you buy the painting, you can have this experience in this poem.
And so somebody has spent his time looking at Hokusai, and said, "Oh, that's a nice way there. Oh, it's a wonderful stylized way he does the drippings and all of that. It's a marvelous painting, or any of the others. But this is what he sees, and he's going through. He's not looking." Blake said, don't look with the eye, but through it. Let life live through you. So if you the surfaces are wonderful if you see them completely.
The Zen photographers would fall into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is a... I have a dear friend who's a photographer, and the black and white process is itself a very meditative process. Mm-hmm. And everyone is, the people who practice it stick with that rather than the digital, still are stunned by the magic of the appearance of something coming out of nothing, out of the emptiness. You stick it in this emulsion. Wow.
When I went and watched Samtan with the
Yeah.
Mandala, I overheard him talking with this one person, and he goes, it's not empty, it's complete.
Yeah.
It's complete.
Mm-hmm.
It's full.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't have a good translation. Emptiness was the closest.
Mm-hmm.
And he said full, complete.
Right.
And that's just been stirring in me.
It's true, we're stuck with that. We're stuck with the usual connotation of emptiness, which is like the worst thing, right? The worst thing that can happen to you if you feel empty. It's funny, with the 19th century American authors that I love so much, they're shot through of Zen, but when it comes to the idea of nothingness, they completely forget. They can't, that's like a place they just cannot go. So they're afraid of it. Because of that misconstruction of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, to go back to my main woman here, Jane Hirschfield. It's called A Room. A room does not turn its back on grief. Anger does not excite it. Before desire, it neither responds nor draws back in fear. Without changing expression, it takes and gives back. Not a tuft in the mattress alters. Window cells evenly welcome both heat and cold. Radiators speak or fall silent as they must. Doors are not equivocal. Floorboards do not hesitate or startle. Impatience does not stir the curtains. A bed is neither irritable nor rapacious. Whatever disquiet we sense in a room, we have brought there. And so I instruct my ribs each morning, pointing to hinge and plaster and wood. You are matter, as they are. See how perfectly it can be done. Hold one day more what is asked. I'll just do it again. A room does not turn its back on grief. Anger does not excite it. Before desire, it neither responds nor draws back in fear. Without changing expression, it takes and gives back. Not a tuft in the mattress alters. Window cells evenly welcome both heat and cold. Radiators speak or fall silent as they must. Doors are not equivocal. Floorboards do not hesitate or startle. Impatience does not stir the curtains. A bed is neither irritable nor rapacious. Whatever disquiet we sense in a room, we have brought there. And so I instruct my ribs each morning, pointing to the hinge and plaster of the wood. Your matter as they are. See how perfectly it can be done. Hold. One day more. What is that? So there we are. Come back around to our koan, which is a koan. This is the first koan in the Book of Serenity or Equanimity. It's so parallel to the Mu koan. One day the world honored one ascended the seat, Manjushri, the embodiment of wisdom, whose name means kindness. Struck the gavel and said, clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. The world honored one got down from the sea. Bam! And gone. So, what do we bring to that emptiness? It matters that it's framed for us. We need to have it framed. If I was to give you a book with no pictures, with no language or pictures or anything in it, you'd think, oh, yeah, great, thanks. It's going to be a defective book. If I was to put Zen on it, you'd say, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, while Stevens called this process of reframing things and refreshing the terms of our perception, the necessary angel. Mm-hmm. Says that everything is covered with a film of the everyday, and the necessary angel comes and lifts that film away. It's still the same thing it was, but now it's different. So, it doesn't matter if it's a Campbell soup can. I read recently that Marcel Duchamp, is a great avant-garde guy. One of his most famous pieces of art is he took a urinal and mounted on the wall. The old-fashioned urinals were shaped like this, like that. Mm-hmm. And it has been pointed out that this is the outline of the Buddha sitting. So, I don't know, how can I end this without sinking into some sort of obscenity?
Dry shit stick.
Yeah. What is Buddha? Oh, I think we can just end there.
Yeah, while you were talking about John Cage and Andy Warhol and stuff, I was thinking of a photographer that I once interviewed for a newspaper story. And he was a Zen student, actually. He introduced me to my first sort of Zen teacher. And he really liked pinhole photography. He was into that because that process takes a long time. So, but one of his projects was just called Up. And he took pictures of power lines. Because he said, you know, most photographers will cut the power lines out of the frame, you know, and that's how they're choosing to frame reality. And so he was choosing to frame reality in a different way and, like, force people to confront the thing that they usually try to frame out, you know.
I think that's a lot of photography, you know, that tries to make us see things in the ordinary, in fresh ways. You could say that about all kinds of art or anything that we do refresh the terms of our orange. And then all of a sudden, wow, we have a moment of beginner's mind. It's great.